The Bob Murphy Show, Episode 11.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Welcome everyone. Happy New Year to you. It's your good friend Bob Murphy giving you the first episode in the new year of 2019. Quick apology, I did not give you guys a heads up back in episode 10 that I was going to be taking a week off, but you know what? I did. Too late now. It's already happened. It's a done deal. But here I am back in the saddle. I'm going to be doing a solo episode for this particular episode talking about the economics of immigration, but let me just explain. There are plenty of interviews lined up that I will be releasing for your pleasure and entertainment and education over the upcoming weeks and months. It's just, it's hard to get people, and I don't want to ask them to record while they got their kids in the background opening their presents. So don't worry, we're going to have more interviews in line for you. But for this episode, again, it's just going to be me, and what I want to provide here is a framework for thinking about the economics of immigration. Now, let me try to diffuse your initial defensiveness, perhaps. I think when it comes to something like immigration, just like even more controversial topics like abortion, people have what their own views are, and they have read a lot of what, quote, the other side has to say about it. And so then if they hear some new person strolling along who wants to chime in, they immediately want to quickly assess, okay, is this guy on my team or the other team? And they listen a little bit, he's with one of them, you know, forget this guy, he's an idiot because he's leaving out considerations X, Y, Z, which everybody on my side knows are the important ones. And I can't believe these morons walking around. I want you to try not to fall into that trap. So the stuff I'm going to say in this particular episode, really, I think whatever your views are on what the U.S. government's policies should be regarding immigration, I think it will just help you augment your position. Really, what I'm trying to do here is just to provide some clarity in thinking through the logic, particularly from an economics perspective of these issues. Because I think a lot of the arguments used by people on both sides, and when I say sides here, I mean those who want the U.S. government to allow a greater number of immigrants per year and those who want it to allow fewer or who want to change the composition of the flow in terms of national origin or whatever, or the various views, I should say, of the different camps in this debate, I think a lot of times they're overlooking some basic results from standard economics. And so I just want to try to inform that. And so you'll see in this episode, I'll be going through just some considerations that I hope will help you think more clearly about these issues just to refine your own position. So again, my goal here is not to talk to one side of the debate and say, hey, you guys have been wrong for the last 10 years. Let me set you straight. That's not what I'm doing here. So go ahead and just relax. Let the conflict flow out of you and just enjoy. So, first point I want to make is the slogan open borders to me seems particularly inapt. And I have in mind the champion of this slogan, Brian Kaplan. And he's, I think, acknowledged as one of the leaders of the open borders movement, certainly in his post as a regular blogger at Econ Log. Brian repeatedly talks about immigration there from the open borders perspective. And so my problem with that is it's not really what Brian's ideal policy is. Brian actually doesn't believe in open borders. What he is against is political coercion from the state. And so for an analogy, if you were against government schools, you wouldn't go around saying that your position was no school, right? Or zero classes or something, you know, some catchy phrase like that, or no algebra, right? You would say, oh, I'm for privatizing education, or I'm for privatizing schools. And so, again, that's It's funny. I promise, folks, I didn't do that on purpose. Brian actually does have a book called The Case Against Education, and I've criticized him in saying that's not really what your position is. So what are you doing? But so I guess he's at least being consistent in choosing bad titles for what his position is. But in any event, I think that it's bad because, number one, it's misleading, but two, it causes unnecessary recoiling on the part of the listener. That somebody who is concerned about what's going on in Europe, for example, and thinks that they have an explanation. Oh my gosh, look at the refugee crisis. And I can't believe Angela Merkel and her crazy policies and da-da-da. You know, that sort of person. You hear Brian Kaplan walking up and talking about open borders and you're going to flip out. When, in fact, Brian doesn't even favor open borders in the sense that I'm saying. So what do I mean? I mean, well, Brian's an anarcho-capitalist. And so he thinks that people who own shopping malls should be able to lock them up at night or even during the day. They can post signs saying, hey, if you're really hammered or you're carrying around a sawed-off shotgun, you're not allowed onto the property. And we will escort you out if we catch you violating our policies. Well, gee, that doesn't sound like open borders. I mean, you're having individuals deciding who can flow in and out of an area or of a region? I thought you were for open borders. And, you know, the obvious response would be, well, that's not what we mean by that phrase. So since Brian's ideal world would have every piece of real estate owned by one or more individuals who could set whatever policies they wanted in terms of which people are allowed to cross the boundaries of that particular piece of property, how is that an advocacy of open borders? So I think that that's really not a great slogan. So I have proposed instead, I'm not just being critical here, I'm trying to offer a solution. I said, why don't you, Brian, adopt the slogan, privatize the borders? To me, that seems like it's what your actual position would be, and it allows you to make all of your normal economic points without tying yourself up in awkward knots, right? That, you know, I think partly what's going on here is guys like Brian and my colleague Ben Powell at Texas Tech, they try to swat down a lot of the standard economic arguments against unrestricted by the government immigration. Like, oh, they're stealing my jobs and that kind of stuff. And I'm going to, in this podcast episode, folks, I'll visit a lot of those topics here and we'll discuss them further. But that's I think the bulk of what their arguments are of the free market economists who say they are for open borders, is that they're trying to swat down the typical economic arguments against immigration, particularly immigration from poorer countries. For people who currently live in the United States and think, oh my gosh, you'd have to be a nut job to favor unrestricted immigration from Haiti or from certain African countries or whatever. That would just kill the economy, blah, 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 blah. And then they have their economic responses. And I'm saying you could still do all of that if your policy prescription were to privatize the borders. And so I don't see why they don't do that. And also notice too that rhetorically, I mean, I think that's really the correct position, that a lot of extreme libertarians liken themselves to the abolitionists, the radical abolitionists, like in the 1840s in the United States. You know, people who were just flat out against slavery and said, no, it's a moral abomination, we should get rid of it. You know, they were considered quite radical. Oh, come on, be reasonable. We have to have a political compromise, and there's various factions, and you don't understand, you know, the voting dynamics here, and if, you know, the regional interests, and, you know, that was a very consistent underlying position, regardless of whether it was politically feasible or not, to state what you actually wanted when you visualized your ideal society. It didn't have slavery, period. And so that's what motivated the radical abolitionists. They didn't care about what was politically feasible. So I'm saying, likewise, in our time, if what you're picturing is you're a radical anarcho-capitalist and you don't think the federal government as a coercive political institution should even exist, so of course you don't think it should have authority regulating what kind of people can cross from Mexico into what's currently called the United States. Okay, that's fine. But then why don't you write that? You know, why don't you say, oh, I'm for privatizing the borders and be real radical and have people say you're a nut job and that'll never happen. Okay, but at least you're consistently writing what your actual position is. Whereas if you said, no, my goal is to have open borders, then that makes it sound like you're saying, oh, I'm okay, or, you know, given that the United States government is going to have all this authority and this coercive power and regulate the flow of people, I think that it should just change the dial and have the, you know, the flow be full open spigot. And so there you, like I say, you run into problems that the people who are against that position are going to think you're crazy and dismiss you. And so you're not really in that conversation, but also it's not really even what your underlying view is, that you don't favor the federal government being in charge of which people can come in and out of the country, and you just wanted to set the dial all the way to the left, for example. That's not really what your position is. Partly, too, you get into trouble because then somebody can come up with little rhetorical counterexamples and things like, for example, Trump recently tweeted out saying that, oh, the Obamas are building a, you know, they have their nice house or mansion and they've got a 10-foot wall around it to keep it safe and secure. And I'm all for that. Good for them. But I just want to do the same thing for the country. And I saw Steve Landsberg responded and called Trump an idiot and saying, you know, no, there's a world of difference here. There's no comparison between the government building a wall and thus preventing other people from making their decisions about who can come and go on their own property versus an individual property owner doing it. And yes, Steve is right in there, but, you know, I don't think that the Obamas or Nancy Pelosi or anybody else who opposes Trump's proposals for building a wall on the border with Mexico, I don't think any of them used one of the arguments, you know, I don't think the federal government ought to be interfering with private decisions at all. You know, there's lots of things that should just be left to the private sector, and the federal government has no role in interfering with people's private decisions. No, of course, that's not the arguments that Pelosi or, you know, Feinstein or these people made when opposing Trump. They have said things like, well, this wall won't work because people could just climb over, or they could dig under it, or da 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 da. And again, they're making arguments against walls per se. And so if you're going to do that, then you leave yourself open to the obvious counter objection of, well, wait a minute, people use walls all the time in their private lives, and especially a lot of the political figures who are opposing Trump on this. So I think you tie yourself up into a knot and you look silly, just like some of the rhetoric in favor of immigration to say like, oh, people have a right to immigrate or a right to move freely. Well, no, they don't. You don't have a right to move freely. You don't have freedom of movement. You can't come into my house. You can't come into my place of business if I don't want you there, right? So there's no such thing as a right to move around. There's private property rights, where there should be. And if we're going to say like what's legally obeyed or endorsed or respected, and that's what the issue is. There is no such abstract thing as a right to freedom of movement. There's no such thing. And so again, I think somebody like Brian has the worst of both worlds there. Like, it's one thing to be nice and consistent and pure and advocate what the best outcome would be, or you can try to be politically relevant. But by him championing what he calls the case for open borders, I think he gets neither, that's not really what his vision is. And right now, that's not politically relevant. There's no way anytime soon the U.S. government is just going to completely drop border enforcement and let anybody who wants to walk into the country. That's not going to happen anytime soon. And so it's you're not even in the conversation. So you're not relevant and you're not even pure. So I don't see what the point of that is. And if you say, well, really, all we're trying to do is to teach people the economics of immigration. Right. I agree. That's a laudable goal. That's one of the things I'm trying to do in this podcast episode. But you don't need to put on a label that's very misleading, in my opinion. All right. So there you go. So there's my opening salvo where I guess I am attacking the choice of labeling that Brian and others have been using on that, even though, as we'll see, I think I probably agree on the economics of it, mostly with the stuff that they would say. So now let's talk some about the economics of immigration. And before we dive into some of the empirical analysis, let's just try to frame the big picture here, some conceptual issues. So one thing is, make sure the way you're thinking about immigration would not also imply that a growing population is a bad thing, right? So give you an example of what I mean. I think some people just automatically assume that, oh my gosh, if we let in enough immigrants to double the U.S. population, that would clearly have a devastating impact. You know, wages would crash, there'd be mass unemployment, there'd be poverty in the streets, there'd be all kinds of rampant crime. Are you kidding me? you know, only a fool could possibly advocate something so reckless as to allow the U.S. population to double by letting in a wave of people equal to the current residential population of the U.S. Okay, if that's your view, well, then does that mean even if we had zero immigration and just had internal growth through birth, right? Population grows that way. And so if we went back far enough in time, we would find a point at which the U.S. population was half of its current value. And so does that mean that, it clearly must be the case that because the population doubled, you know, there's 50% unemployment from that year till right now, and that nobody can find work, and we're obviously on the verge of starvation, and there's mass homelessness in the streets and what have you, because all of a sudden the population that the country had to support doubled? Well, no, that's obviously not the case, right? So there's not a fixed number of jobs. It's not that adding more people necessarily causes a strain on the carrying capacity of the economic infrastructure, right? That as population grows over time, even just if it's through natural birth, the economy adjusts, wage rates adjust, and so forth. And in fact, that actually goes hand in hand with a rising standard of living, empirically speaking. And in fact, in many countries that have a declining birth rate, even social conservatives, the kind of people who typically are against immigration, are fretting about, oh my gosh, our declining fertility. This is crazy. You know, the country's imploding here. We got to do something about this. How come our families aren't having more kids here to at least replace the population that's dying? Okay, so generally speaking, a growing population, if it's through internal biological reproduction, is considered a good thing. All right. So again, I'm just saying, you know, that point right there, I mean, I know there's lots of further things people could say. It's, when we talk about immigrants coming in, there are different cultures. I get all that, folks. I'm just saying, make sure, again, that the point of this podcast episode, I'm not trying to make you change what your ultimate position is. I just want you to refine your arguments and the way you're thinking about it. Make sure if, for example, if you're against waves of immigrants coming in, make sure that the arguments you're using or the way you're thinking about it wouldn't also, quote, prove that a positive growth rate from birth would devastate your country, because presumably you don't believe that. You think that it's fine that the U.S. right now has a bigger population than it did in the year 1800, and that doesn't doom us to poverty, because how can we support all these extra mouths to feed? Or how could it possibly be if the labor force now was way higher than it was in the year 1800? How can anybody get a job? Or how can wage rates in real terms possibly be higher now than the year 1800 when the quantity of labor is so much higher? I mean, geez, doesn't the demand curve for labor slope downward? So if there's so many more workers walking around today than in the year 1800, haven't wage rates plummeted because now all these workers are competing against each other? It's a race to the bottom. Well, you see that's obviously not true empirically. Right? Workers now are much richer. 1 hour of your labor now gets much more goods and services in terms of the wage rate you get paid than what can you go on the market and buy with that than was the case in the year 1800, even though the workforce now is obviously much bigger than the year 1800. And it's not that economics is wrong for thinking supply and demand curves make sense. It's that there's other things aren't equal. That's one quick way of looking at it. Okay. Another thing I want you to make sure that's fitting into your worldview here when you think about this stuff. So there I've just tried to show you over time that increasing population over time does not necessarily spell poverty or declining standard of living. If anything, it's the opposite. And so you might think, okay, Murphy, but you know that was over a long time span, for example. And so, yeah, other things changed. There was technological innovation. There was savings and capital accumulation and did it. Okay. Even within a country, just a current snapshot, the current time period, looking throughout the country, let's just take the United States, where do you see high standards of living? Do you see it where the population density is high or low? So, for example, if you look at New York City, the population density there is a lot higher than it is in Boise, Idaho, for example. And so does that mean all the people living in New York City are on the verge of starvation and that, you know, there's just a bunch of slums in New York City and all the richest people in the country live in the very sparsely populated areas? No, actually, if anything, it's the other way around, right? That the richest people in the United States tend to be in clusters, to be living in big cities. Now, to be sure, there are large pockets of slums in big cities also, but the point is population density per se does not seem to be causing poverty, that it's precisely in the biggest cities in the United States where you see the wealthiest individuals. And so again, if your view is, oh, no, is population or as the workforce goes up, that necessarily pushes down wage rates, then you should think that the poorest or the lowest wage rates ought to be in places like Manhattan, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, in Houston. And yet, no, basically it's the exact opposite of that, that that's where wage rates are the highest, especially just in nominal terms. Okay, even if you're doing something fairly menial or that doesn't take a lot of skills, you're going to tend to get paid more per hour in big cities than elsewhere, just empirically. I'm just, you know, that's a simple fact. And so you can see that things are a lot more nuanced than merely looking at, gee, if the quantity of workers in an area goes way up because of an influx of people, then the only possible outcome is just textbook economics, is that wage rates have to plummet, because that seems to be at odds with just what's staring you in the face. That, so again, it's not just over time that as the U.S. population as a whole has gone up, that goes hand in hand with rising prosperity and standards of living. It's also at any given point in time, just take a snapshot of the country and look around, and the wealthiest areas are certainly not very sparse. And if anything, the big cities are where the most productive, high-income people live and work. And so something is going on there. So partly what's happening there is that as population density goes up, there's various ways to talk about it, but there's economies of scale, or there's, you know, network effects. There's different ways and different nuances in the economics literature of modeling it. But the point is that highly productive people, if you put them all in one little area, they can collaborate with each other. And so that's why you don't want all the best accountants and all the best lawyers and all the best engineers and computer programmers and people who are very savvy in terms of the financial markets. If they were just, let me put it this way. If some of the views I have seen to oppose immigration on economic grounds saying, oh, dude, just draw a supply and demand curve on the blackboard. Can't you see if more people come in, that's obviously going to make the native workers earn lower wages. If that were true, then you would think just internally in terms of the United States that with free migration between the states, you know, and once you're in the United States, or let's say, well, among citizens, you can travel freely within the country, you would think workers would just move around uniformly such that there would be a nice even spread of people across the country and wage rates would be tend to be uniform. And that if there were any pockets of higher than normal density of workers jammed into an area, you would think that area would have below average wages until the workers moved away from there to try to spread themselves out as much as possible. Sort of like, you know, electrons on a charged sphere or something, trying to go on the surface and get as far away from each other as possible. That's the logic of a lot of the people who I see talking about wage rates in response to an influx of immigrants. And so clearly that's not right empirically, that there's a countervailing force where for some reason, no, actually when workers get concentrated together, that increases their productivity. And so I'm saying part of what's going on there is you're able to collaborate with complementary workers if you're in proximity to them. And so that's one of the things going on. If you're a really superstar accountant, you're probably going to move to a big city, or at least that's where you're going to earn the most money. So maybe you're going to stay away for other reasons, but if what you want to maximize is how many dollars per year is your company paying you, you clearly are going to move to one of the big cities in the United States. You're not going to earn the highest possible paycheck for all sorts of standard professions if you live out in a real rural area. You got to move to a big city. Now, there's downsides there, right? That, you know, the population density, you know, the rents will be high, your living quarters will be smaller and so on, or maybe you'll have to commute longer. And so that's why not literally every single person lives in big cities. But my point is, the thing that makes big cities possible, despite all the downsides, you know, crowded subways and seeing rats on the street and the litter and the smells, one of the upsides, besides people who like Broadway shows and things like that, is that you can earn a higher paycheck for a lot of professions if you're willing to work in a big city. That's where the money is. Okay, so again, that is the direct opposite of the standard intuition that a lot of people use when they're talking about the economics of immigration and what does it do to wage rates. All right, let me throw another curveball at you. It's, I think, wrong to think merely in terms of workers or not, right? That actually, in practice, there's different types of workers, and so you want to ultimately get more nuanced than the way you're thinking about it. And so there can be, if there's an influx of a certain type of worker, that might have one impact versus another. And so here, too, you want to think about when you say, like, oh, would letting in immigrants hurt Americans or help Americans, right? That's usually what people have in mind. And so let me ask you this. Let's suppose the U.S. government next year all of a sudden deports 90% of the heart surgeons that currently live in the United States. Okay, so right now in the United States, there's a certain number of heart surgeons going to work in hospitals and clinics every day. And let's say next year the U.S. government takes 90% of them and deports them, so they're no longer in the U.S. What are the effects of that policy? You know, the economic effects, think of it that way. You know, putting aside the heartache and so on, and the family ties, just economically in terms of the wage rates and standard of living of Americans, what's the effect of that? So one obvious impact is that the heart surgeons who get deported are clearly worse off, right? They're not going to be able to earn as much money doing heart surgery in other countries, chances are, right? So they're clearly hurt. And you say, oh, well, if we're counting them as the Americans or part of the group, then their losses have to be factored. But let's put that aside. Let's say, let's not even worry about the fate or the plight of the heart surgeons who get deported. Let's consider the Americans who stay in the country after the heart surgeons get deported. Those are the ones we're focusing on. So clearly who's benefited are the 10% of remaining heart surgeons. Right now, their salaries go way up, because 90% of the competition just got eliminated, right? So they're clearly better off from that. In their role as heart surgeons, their salaries will tend to go way up. But what's the effect on everybody else? Well, now all of a sudden heart surgery is way more expensive. And if you had to get an operation, you got to wait longer for that to happen. Or the quality will go down. Like, you know, people in medical school now will get shunted into heart surgery because the pay is so attractive, who aren't going to be as qualified or as competent as the people who just got displaced, right? Because the existing stock before the deportation occurred were who they were, is because the best people, the most qualified people, the most suitable people for being heart surgeons were doing that. And so you take them away. It's not that the market will just forever be stuck with that same number of now only 10% of the original stock of heart surgeons. More people will fill the void, but you'll be pulling doctors away from other areas who, like I said, had specialized in other things, or up and coming people in medical school, more of them will go into heart surgery who otherwise wouldn't have. But the point is, you're clearly going to have fewer heart surgeries and lower quality heart surgeries conducted after the deportation. So I think as a first pass, it's correct to say the deported heart surgeons clearly get crushed in terms of their standard of living. The ones who stay behind, the original ones, like the ones who were heart surgeons before the deportation and then survived that 90% evacuation or removal, they're clearly better off in terms of just narrow pecuniary considerations. Their salaries go way up. And the other Americans in their role as potential consumers of healthcare services, namely heart surgeries, and other healthcare, by the way. So it's not just the people who need to get heart surgery are losers, but also the people who have to get medical services that now are also more scarce because the people who would have been doing that job got redirected to become a heart surgeon who otherwise wouldn't have, right? So there's a crunch all across the medical field that sort of emanates out in waves, sucking people into heart surgery who otherwise wouldn't be there. Okay, so it's not obvious, or I should say, so it's, yeah, it's not obvious why anyone would think that deporting 90% of the heart surgeons would help the Americans who stayed behind. You would have a lot of benefits for a concentrated few people in that one sector, namely the heart surgeons who survived the experiment or the procedure, the removal. And then generally speaking, other Americans would be big losers. And you could say that the amount of the loss would be dependent on, were you going to get a medical procedure related to heart surgery or something that somebody who could do something that was similar to heart surgery anytime soon after that transition, right? So that's the way it would look there. And so I'm saying that is kind of the way you want to start thinking about this stuff. And so you can see, what if I did it the other way around? We start now at the, you know, after that first experiment happened, and now we reverse it. Now we bring in 9 times the number of heart surgeons from abroad and flood the market with them. Who are the winners and losers? Well, those heart surgeons who were there originally, their wages are going to go down, but everybody else benefits. Okay, so you see how that works. And so likewise, with immigration, more generally speaking, it's not really helpful just to look at it in terms of, well, you know, Americans or not. You can, you know, start getting much more nuanced and say, well, who do you mean? So the workers who are competing with particular immigrants, yeah, you might be able to say that their particular wage rates go down, but notice that doesn't mean all workers in general. It certainly doesn't mean all Americans in general. All right, so let's just, again, just think this through. And also, if you're considering human welfare, the immigrants themselves coming in clearly benefit from it. Hey, folks, you notice the stock market's been kind of crazy lately? I hate to say it, but Carlos Lara and I have been warning about the weakness of the stock market for years now. And as the Fed continues to tighten, this is exactly the sort of thing we were worried would happen. For more analysis, not just big picture, oh, Federal Reserve bad, QE bad. No. We get much more detailed than that. But for our analysis of the financial sector, including interviews with top flight economists and other people in the financial markets, you want to check out the Lara Murphy Report. So for ordering information and also for all the free samples we have available, go to bobmurphyshow.com/LMR. Now, on this point, what's interesting is sometimes the way people will handle this issue is they'll say something like, oh, sure, yeah, as immigrants come in, they push down wages, right? The effect of the supply of labor increasing tends to push down the wage rates. But on the other hand, the immigrants, they go buy stuff too. So that tends to push up, you know, the prices that the firms can charge. And so that tends to push up wage rates because now, you know, firms make more money because they got more demand for their product. And so it's not clear what the net impact of an influx of immigrants will be on the native workers. And so, yes, we believe in supply and demand, but you just have to be, you know, you have to be consistent about it. You have to be holistic. Don't just narrowly look at the impact of the immigrants coming in their capacity as workers. You also have to look at them in their capacity as consumers and keep in mind that, yep, those wages they're getting paid when they, quote, steal our jobs, they're also going to go back out in the marketplace and spend a lot of that money and therefore creating more jobs. And so, hey, it could be a wash, or you don't know what the net. Okay, that's wrong. That's not a useful way to think about it. So the benefit, if there is a benefit economically of immigrants coming into the country, is not that they consume stuff. Okay, just think through this with me for a minute here. Okay, again, don't worry about your own particular views on immigration. Just let's make sure we're thinking about this properly. If 1,000 people come over to the U.S. and they start working, generally speaking, that helps people in the United States, right? There's more stuff to go around. If those 1,000 people that came over then start consuming, there's less stuff to go around, right? So pushed to the logical extreme, the people who say, oh, the benefit of immigration economically is that they spend money, you would say the best of all worlds would be if a bunch of people came over here, did no work, and just consumed a bunch of stuff. And that's, no, that would also, that would be like a freeloader or a parasite, right? That's what's interesting about some of this rhetoric or the way these people, some of these people think through these things, is that it's as if, you know, really what you're worried about is somebody coming over here and working and supporting themselves. And in fact, the worst of all things would be somebody who works more than he consumes. Oh, geez, we don't want that kind of a person coming. But no, that's good. That's what you'd want. I mean, this might be a bit loaded and perhaps too emotional a topic to shed light on it, but you know, some powerful country goes and conquers some other people and brings them in as slaves, right? Does that mean that that's not contributing to national output then? Because, oh geez, the slaves aren't going out and buying stuff at the store. No, I mean, that's, if you're evil and maniacal and all you want to do is exploit somebody else for your own personal gain, you make them work and you just give them enough to survive, right? You would never, I mean, according to this logic, what you would really do if you really wanted to get ahead is you'd go conquer some other people, force them to come over to your country, say, now you're not allowed to work and produce anything, but we want you to go into our malls and take TV sets and, you know, go into our grocery stores and take some of the food and so on that otherwise our people would be able to enjoy, and then you consume it. Ha ha ha. This will be the way we get ahead. I bet you're sorry that we conquered you now that you're sitting there forced to consume and we're not letting you produce anything. No, that's stupid. That's exactly backwards. Okay, so another way of thinking about it, like let's say they're, you know, building a bunch of robots that are going to augment production in the United States, right? So there's this fleet of thousands and thousands of robots coming off the assembly line, and they go into the factories and whatever, and they're able to produce cars or whatever and TV sets and so on. Okay, they're not, you know, as versatile as human labor, but they're pretty good and they can crank stuff out. Now, does it make us richer or poorer if I tell you that the robots need a lot of inputs to keep going, right? That the robots consume a lot of electricity, let's say, or geez, you really need a lot of oil that these robots go through in order to keep them operating and cranking stuff out. Or if I tell you, you know, these robots are amazing. Not only do they crank out all these cars and TV sets per hour, but they run on sunlight. You don't need to put any other resources into them. They're just self-sustaining in terms of just stuff they get from the physical environment there. And they just run unaided, unattended for years on end, cranking stuff out. Is that good or bad? If they don't need more inputs, that's good, right? That means everybody else gets to consume the extra output they're producing without suffering any loss of things that are necessary inputs to keep those robots going. So likewise, if you had a bunch of immigrants who crossed into the geographical border or boundary of what's called the United States, and they just started producing a bunch of stuff and didn't consume anything, that would be awesome. That would just be more stuff for us. That would be the equivalent of, you know, some foreign government subsidizing its exports and sending over free cars or TVs to the United States. So yes, that would have a negative economic impact on the particular U.S. companies and workers who are directly making those specific things, the so-called dumped products. But Americans as a whole would be richer if some foreign government decided to send a bunch of free cars or TVs over because it wanted to boost its exports for some reason. All right, that makes Americans richer, not poorer. So most free market people get that logic when it comes to imports. And so I'm saying, if we're just right now narrowly looking at the commercial aspects of it or the physical production, we're not worried about culture and voting and stuff like that. The fact that immigrants could come over into the country and work, produce a bunch of stuff, and then not spend any money, if anything, that would be awesome. You know, far from you complaining about that, that means they're producing things without using up any resources in the process. All right, so that's, again, just to clarify that if you want to say it's an inadequate analysis just to look at the impact from immigrants in their role as workers and that, oh, they depress wages, and that the way you want to rebut that is to say, oh, well, they take their wages and they go spend it on stuff and they push up. No, that's not a good argument. That's not the right way to think about it. Okay. There's other ways to try to rebut the argument. Like I said, you could say that it is an influx of workers comes in. It raises the productivity of other types of workers. Okay. So that's kind of what's going on with the city example, for example, right? That a certain flow of accountants into Manhattan, other things equal, yes, reduces the wage rate of accountants, at least in the short run, but it raises the productivity and hence wage rates of complementary fields, right? That if you're an engineer working at a company, well, if the company hires an accountant, now the company is more effective. And so you as an engineer are more effective. And so your pay goes up. And so that's maybe the way to think about it, that as more workers join an enterprise who have different types of skills, you are helping particularly the people whose skills differ from yours. For those of you who have studied formal economics somewhat, I mean, there's a standard workhorse model called the Cobb-Douglas production function, and you know they have different models, solo growth model, things like that. What I'm getting at here is like if the quantity of labor goes up, well, then that increases the earnings of capital equipment. And vice versa, if the quantity of capital goes up, well, then wage rates go up because now workers are working with more tools and equipment. Okay, so I'm saying if you have a more general model where there's not just labor, but there's different types of labor, well, then an increase in the quantity available of one type of labor, yes, other things equal, is going to lower the earnings of that particular type of worker, but it's going to raise the wage rates of other types of workers. And so in general, if you're allowing an influx of all kinds of workers, then it's not clear what the net result's going to be. Because yeah, the influx of accountants into New York City is going to lower the wage rate of accountants and raise wage rates of other workers. But you're not just letting accountants in, you're letting in plumbers and janitors and engineers and heart surgeons and cab drivers and da 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 da. And so it's not clear if you double the population of New York City, especially if you do it over a period of time to allow for adjustments and whatnot, it's not obvious that everybody's wage rates are going to be lower. In fact, empirically, historically, it looks like as the population of New York City grew, the standard of living rose. All right. So I'm trying to show you why that's consistent with a downward sloping demand curve for labor on the part of employers, that we're not overturning economics here. I'm just saying that the real problem with just looking at it as the supply and demand for labor is that there's not just one type of labor. There's actually all kinds of labor, and there's different individual labor markets for different occupations or different skill sets. All right, so that's part of what's going on here. Now, let me just mention this. I don't know where else to put this into the discussion, but I've heard people say stuff like, well, what we're overlooking here is, you know, when you bring in workers who are of lower skills than the prevailing ones, that's bad. Or people, you know, who just, you know, they don't have the education or whatever. That's bad. Yeah. So we agree with you, Murphy, or other economists, that having immigration or even free trade with countries that are like ours is fine, but you don't want to deal with inferior. Again, if you're making it a pretty strict economic argument, if you're not talking about voting and stuff like that, and we'll get into that the last segment of this episode, that doesn't really work. Like if a stockbroker is hungry and decides he wants a hard taco and he goes into Taco Bell to buy his meal, it's not that his wages suddenly plummet, right? Like the fact that he's mixing his economy with people who are beneath him in terms of productivity, that doesn't hurt him in any way, right? So in general, trading with somebody who has lower skills than you makes you better off, right? Or at least having the option of doing that, or just going the other way, for the government to arbitrarily restrict your ability to trade with people who might have a lower absolute productivity than you in different possible outlets, that doesn't make you better off. If the government does that, that hurts you, that reduces your options. Let me put you this way. What's the IQ of a hammer? It's pretty low, right? Hammers are pretty stupid. Nails, 2x4s. So did I just prove that if there was a big influx in the United States of hammers and 2x4s, that would make our economy worse off? No, of course not. Or what about, if there's a lot more chickens? What if there's a lot more pack animals, especially for countries that rely on animals to pull plows and stuff? If the quantity of horses all of a sudden goes up, or donkeys or mules goes up in those countries, does that lower their GDP because now the average intelligence among biological organisms went down? Of course not. Sorry. So I'm being a bit facetious here, but my point is, even a lot of these people who get into stuff that I don't want to get into more in this episode, I'm just going to lightly step into it and then move on. But I hope you get my point that even on their own terms, people talking about IQ and stuff like that, in terms of just strict economics, a lot of what they say is a total non sequitur. That if you took their same logic and say, oh, we can't let these people in because of their IQ, or, well, you just proved you can't import calculators or something, you know, that obviously isn't correct. Okay. I think obviously the last line of defense for those who think that there's a big difference between imported goods versus people is it has to do with culture and voting. And so they'll say that, well, actually, and also with the welfare state, all right? And so there you could say, yeah, the reason China dumping electronic goods on the U.S. doesn't hurt us, or if Japan wants to subsidize its car exports, the reason that's still a net gain is because the Japanese car's not going to get in the United States and all of a sudden start getting food stamps. You know, you idiot Murphy. So that's why, okay, and fair enough. So I'm not saying goods are literally people. Again, I'm just trying to make sure your argument against more immigration based on economics would not also, quote, prove that an increased importation of hammers all of a sudden makes us poor or something like that. So just make sure you're being consistent. And so, yes, if one of the ways you want to try to distinguish those cases is to say, well, people coming in, they're taking welfare, that's certainly a consideration. And I am not here going to take a stand on that, because let me let you guys in on a little secret. Economists can prove just about anything they want with empirical studies. Okay, so if I wanted to set out and I wanted to prove to you that immigrants tend to use more in public services than they pay in taxes, I could do that. Or if I wanted to prove the opposite, I could do that. And in both cases, I wouldn't even be lying or dishonest. It's just that I would frame the study and I would, rely on a certain consideration in ways that tend to favor one outcome or the other. And I could probably get the answer I want. And that's why you will see different studies claiming diametrically opposed things. And if you go and parse them and say, well, how can it be that this study says immigrants contribute $1.52 for every dollar they receive in benefits? And this study over here says that, oh my gosh, immigrants are a huge net drain on society. Well, you look at it closely and they're probably measuring different things. Like some might be looking at a particular subset of immigrants. Some things might just be considering certain types of public services. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Right. Okay. So that's why I think that that's a dangerous path to go down, because you can get whatever you want. So all I would say, I suppose, is if you have your set statistics that you think, just show the case one way or the other, at least Google around and try to find studies that say the opposite and just look and see what the differences are, just to make sure that there's not some obvious flaw or thing that's being left out of the particular study or studies that you have in your back pocket for when you get into arguments on Facebook or whatever with this stuff. Okay, so again, I'm not saying you're wrong for what you're relying on, but just to make sure you have a complete picture, go ahead and try to find reputable studies that have the opposite conclusion to see what they said. Because a lot of times, by the way, that's a good way of bolstering your own position. I'll do that sometimes, or actually I do that a lot. Most of what I read, in fact, online is from people I disagree with. Obviously, with Tom Woods, I have contra Krugman, so I spend a lot of time reading Krugman's stuff. But even beyond that, I spend very little time at the websites featuring my buddies, like at the Mises Institute or whatever, because we largely agree on stuff and I know what their views are. Whereas I spend most of my time online looking at opinions that differ from mine just to, you know, sharpen my own position. But it also reinforces if I see, okay, yeah, the most eloquent, sharpest people who disagree with me on something, let me see their best case. And if I look at it and say, that doesn't really do anything to what my position is, then that actually reassures me. So again, just I encourage you to go out and try to find studies saying the opposite of what your view is on whether immigrants help or hurt government finances, to just see what kind of arguments. Let me put it this way, because you can always come up with a case to say, aha, you see, immigrants on net are a boon to the treasury, or aha, immigrants on net are a burden to taxpayers. You can easily come up with studies showing one or the other. And so what's interesting is go and look and see what did the authors have to do to come up with those results. And then, you know, you can decide, you know, looking at those two different outcomes, and you could say, okay, what do I think is closer to the truth? Just like another example with the Seattle minimum wage experiment, right? The Seattle government, city government, hired a University of Washington economist to study their big minimum wage increase. And the team found that it was bad and it hurt workers. And so they didn't like that result. The politicians didn't like that result. And so they got people from UC Berkeley to do the same study. And they found the minimum wage increase helped workers. Woo, that's great. So again, just shows you the magic tricks you can do with econometrics. So it's not that one set of authors was lying or being dishonest. You can look at the studies, and if you get hip deep into the details, you can see that actually they were measuring different things and they had different data sets and even though they were ostensibly looking at literally the same historical period, right? It wasn't even like it was looking at one city's raise of the minimum wage versus some other cities. They were both looking at Seattle, the same increase in the minimum wage, and these two teams of economists came up with the opposite conclusions as reported by the media. So how can that be? Well, you go and get into the details and you can see what they had to do. Okay, likewise with these empirical measurements of do immigrants help or hurt vis-a-vis the taxpayers. As far as the empirical evidence on this stuff, let me mention also, before I forget, there's a problem because the taxpayer stuff, that's just one component of it. And so, in other words, you could be a net drain on the taxpayer but still be benefiting the U.S. economy. Or I suppose it's probably even the opposite's true as well, though I had to think through that a bit more. I guess certainly if you allow coercion, that you might be a net contributor of taxes but be hurting other people. And so that's I'm not saying that's definitive or that's the metric you want to use. But in terms of the wage rates, the problem with the empirical stuff is there's causality and correlation problems, right? That it's right now immigration flows are politically regulated. And that could, you know, the economic health of the country could affect what happens. And so, for example, you know, in the 1930s, during the Hoover administration, there was a crackdown on immigration in the early 30s. And so clearly that went hand in hand with a bad economy. But, you know, that's not fair, because you could say, oh, well, no, it's not that if you were in favor of more restrictive immigration policy, you could quite plausibly say, no, it's because the economy was really bad for other reasons that the Hoover administration cracked down on it. And it's not that the crackdown on immigration in the early 30s contributed to the bad economy, right? You could say that, and you know, quite plausibly. So that's kind of the problem. Or even internally, in the United States internally, if you wanted to do econometric measurements of immigration flows between states or cities, again, you'd run into the problem, like a particular city has a booming economy, you know, whatever, Chicago's doing great for some reason, then you would tend to see people in other cities moving out of the, you know, in some other cities stagnating. Detroit's doing awful. And so you would see a flow of immigrants, you know, U.S. citizens out of Detroit and into Chicago. And so you wouldn't want to conclude merely from that analysis or those data that, oh, see, immigration's good and emigration's bad. Immigration tends to raise wages because the wage rates in Chicago were rising during this period and the wage rates in Detroit were falling, even though workers were moving out of Detroit into Chicago. So therefore, immigration raises wage rates. You wouldn't want to say that, because the causality could obviously be the other way around, that it was the movement in wage rates that was attracting the workers and so on. Right. So that's the problem with this stuff and why one of the most famous episodes to study in the empirical economics literature is the Mariel Boatlift. And so here I am by no means an expert on this stuff, but what happened here was in, I'm just looking at the Wikipedia summary. It was between mid-April and late October in 1980. And so what happened is, for whatever reason, Fidel Castro decided anybody in Cuba who wanted to go to the United States was allowed to do so for this brief period. And they left Cuba's Mariel Harbor, and it was the anti-Castro people in southern Florida who sort of organized the boat lift, like to get the people from the Mariel Harbor in the United States. And so a lot of them ended up in Miami. Like that's where they first, landed. And during this period, it was something like 125,000 Cubans that were moved from Cuba to Miami. Right. And so so the reason this is considered a good experiment is that, it was a pretty big exogenous shock, right? That this is a boom, a quick increase. It was certainly unexpected. And it was a kind of thing where it's not perfect, because maybe part of the reason, and some do say this, that maybe why Castro allowed it was because of the economy there. So, but it's not that all of a sudden the Florida economy was doing awesome and that somehow influenced Castro to let those people go, right? So you wouldn't want to look at the impact on wage rates in the Cuban economy, but just looking at the Miami labor market to see what happened, right? So that's why this is considered to be a pretty good experiment, because it was a big shock. And again, it was not that the political authorities in Miami or Florida opened up things because the economy was doing so well, right? So that's not what was going on. So initially, David Card, the same guy who's the Card-Kruger minimum wage economist, he studied the impact of the boat lift on the Miami labor market, and he found that it didn't really have much of an impact. Yeah, there might have been a slight depression of wages, but it disappeared soon enough, and no big deal. So it looked like the Miami labor market was able to absorb this 125,000 new immigrants over the course of just a few months, and no big deal. Then George Borjas comes along. I hope I'm pronouncing his name right. And if not, it's embarrassing, because I've heard my colleague Ben Powell say his name a bunch and and I just forgot how to pronounce it, but I think I'm pronouncing it right. So it's Borjas. He's an economist at Harvard. And he's one of the leading economists who favors a more restrictive immigration policy on economic grounds. This guy, George Borjas, an economist at Harvard. So what he did is, he somewhat famously in these circles published a reevaluation of the findings of Card. And Borjas claims that Card looked at the aggregate labor market and didn't find a big impact, but that if you get more specific, if you look at, for example, just high school dropouts and their wage rates in, the native people working in Miami, if you just focus on people who are high school dropouts, then you do see a pretty dramatic impact on their wages. And so what he found was that, relative, and he sets up control groups and stuff. So this stuff, they try to correct for obvious possible biases, things that, like looking at the labor market in Miami compared to some other comparable cities, and then say, okay, now there's this influx of 125,000 Cubans into the Miami labor market, and then looking at how wage rates among Miami workers who were there all along and don't have a high school diploma, how do their wage rates compare to their cohorts in other cities that are not affected by the, Cuban immigrants who also don't have a high school diploma? And that's the kind of thing they're measuring with this stuff, in case you're wondering about what are they controlling for. That's, at this first pass, they do control for that kind of stuff. So what Borjas found was that over the course of several years, the wage rates of Miamians who did not have a high school degree went down 10 to 30%. Okay. And so he's saying, hey, that's a pretty big impact. And by the way, the reason he was saying that's the relevant group is that at least 60% of the Mariolitos, that's the term coming from someone who probably has a horrible Spanish accent, that's the term for the immigrants of this so-called Mariel boat lift, right? That at least 60% of them did not have the equivalent of a U.S. high school diploma. And so Borjas's point is you wouldn't expect a group of 125,000 people coming in, the majority of whom don't have a high school diploma, you wouldn't expect that to crush the wage rates of heart surgeons. What you would expect is for it to hurt the wage rates of similarly less educated native workers. And he's saying, yep, and I did find that, right? So that's the conclusion. So I've seen a lot of people say, okay, even on its own terms, that's not an earth-shattering result. That's not some huge crushing blow against immigration. But I do just want to bring you up to speed on when economists argue about that stuff, that's what they find. So more generally, just to make sure I'm not giving you a misleading picture, more generally, the empirical assessments of immigration tend to find a very modest impact on absolute wage rates, right? That it seems like, as you know, a bunch of immigrants come in, they tend to be absorbed into the workforce without a huge drop in wage rates. And so again, what Borjas's position is, I believe it's fair to say, is that that's misleading because in our world, most governments do heavily regulate the flow of immigrants. And you also have these causality problems where, you know, one place is having a really great economy, more immigrants are going to flow there. So it's hard to see how much would wage rates have risen if a government had maintained a very restrictionist policy. And so Borjas thinks they would have gone up even more, that kind of thing. Right. So in general, economists have found that there wasn't much of an impact. And again, the classic study in this where it seemed like it was a pretty good, quote, natural experiment was this Mariel boat lift in 1980. And originally the 1990s study by Card found that, no, just like, you know, in line with the other literature, looks like this didn't have a big impact at all. And then Borjas comes along and says, no, if we focus more narrowly on people who don't have a high school diploma, then the drop in wage rates is anywhere from 10 to 30%. Okay, so again, the pro-immigration person could plausibly say, give me a break. Even in this, you know, quote, worst case example, worst case scenario, you're finding that wage rates among other workers went up, right? So the influx of low-educated workers tends to raise the real wages of higher skilled workers. And even among their direct competitors, it's not, you know, it's not that their wage rates dropped catastrophically. Okay. So that's the way they do. But to me, this is more in line with, you know, the stuff I was saying earlier in the podcast episode to you guys now, that it's, you really don't want to think about in terms of labor versus not labor. It's different types of labor. And so what's happening when you have immigrants coming in, especially from poorer regions, one way that economists might talk about it is that allows U.S. workers to specialize in other things. Okay, so I'm going to engage in gross stereotypes here, but if you have a bunch of workers coming in who, you know, are going to pick fruit, well, then that lowers wage rates in the fruit picking industry or sector, and then American workers tend to get shunted into other areas. And overall, you know, so overall production goes up and in general, American standards of living go up. But yeah, I think it would be wrong to try to say there's not literally a single person who's going to be negatively affected by that. Just like, again, if, you know, some foreign car company all of a sudden is allowed to send its cars in the United States, you can argue that that's going to raise the standard of living of Americans, but it would be kind of silly to try to deny that some particular workers would be hurt by that. Hey, folks, let's take a pause from my discussion of the economics of immigration to talk about the Three Lads and the Lizard King, three young folks who immigrated into the Lizard King's realm. If you're not up to speed on what I'm talking about, I wrote a story for my son. It's a children's story, illustrated. It's the works. Came out in 2013. And I am going to devote an episode of the Bob Murphy Show in late January of 2019 to an analysis of this topic, because I think there's a lot I packed into the story that everybody would appreciate, not just little kids. So to go ahead and get your copy, but also to read the reviews in case you're on the fence, like, why the heck would I want Bob talking about some kids' story? Trust me, there's a lot going on in this story. It's not just for little kids. Go to bobmurphyshow.com/lizard and see what all the fuss is about. Now, on this issue of Borjas, I've seen him make the point that, you know, hey, in the present world, it's really hard to extrapolate from these issues, you know, from the narrow data that we have, because governments so heavily regulate the flow of immigration, and that gives us little insight into what would happen if we open the floodgates. So let me just throw this out here in terms of, geez, what would happen if the government did do that? Keep in mind, a lot of the U.S. right now is empty space, and I think a lot of times we forget that. And so it's not clear, you know, what the overall impact would be, especially if you just had a totally free market in individual property owners. But let me just throw this out as a data point that, to a first approximation, I think it's true that something like, if you took the whole world's population and you put them in the United States at the average density of people living in New York City, they would all fit into Texas, right? So again, let me repeat that. Even if the entire population of planet Earth moved into the United States, they could all fit within Texas and only have a density of what we currently have in New York City. And, you know, so I'm just trying to get you to see that I think sometimes people have this idea that, well, clearly you couldn't have unrestricted immigration because, you know, people would be piled up on the streets 10 people high. No, that's not true. That, again, most of the land area of the United States is empty space. So that's not what would happen. And obviously, if all the people were packed into Texas, there would be issues, and that wouldn't make sense economically. They wouldn't stay there. They would spread out. But my point is just to make sure you're thinking about it correctly. Like, don't worry about just literal piling up of people. Even if absolutely every single person on Earth came in the United States, it's not that we would run out of room, right? So just make sure you have that point. Last thing here, last topic is, okay, Murphy, you're sitting there dancing around these issues. What are we supposed to do? There's no good answer, right? There is no good answer. Just like in public schools or government schools, there's no good answer to the questions like, gee, should the teacher be allowed to lead the kids in prayer before they go to lunch? Or, you know, can you have up a Christmas tree in public parks and things like that? There's no good answer. That the people on both sides of the issue have very compelling points. And the ultimate solution is to privatize everything. So that's why I'm saying, to me, you know, it's pointless to argue about, well, gee, should the federal government have more immigrants or fewer? That's like saying, should the Soviet Union's government have produced more cars or more bread? Or, you know, we don't know. Ultimately, the only way you're going to know is to privatize everything and let the market decide. So likewise, I don't know what the optimal number of people from Mexico flowing into what we now call Texas is per year. I have no idea, nor does anyone else. And so ultimately, the way you figure that out is to privatize everything, including all the real estate, and let owners set their policies. And then whatever happens, you'd say, well, that's the best approximation. Just like, if you want to know how many TVs ought to be produced, just have everything be private and let the market decide. Okay, so, and I'm not saying that merely as a cop-out or something, because I don't want to be controversial. I'm saying that's really the answer. My colleague Ben Powell, I like the fact that he hits that point often when he talks about this stuff. And the show notes page, remember, guys, this is episode 11. So go to bobmurphyshow.com/11. I'll give links to some of the stuff that Ben Powell has done on this, because immigration, the economics of immigration is one of his key areas. I'll give links to some of his pop stuff where you can, you know, learn more and get more reading if you want on this, including a debate at the Soho Forum that perhaps, if you want to see two people go head to head on this topic, then, you know, they might want to watch that. So that's ultimately my solution, is to privatize the borders. And if you say, oh, come on, that's too easy, or you're not really, okay, well, if you want something more political, then say, let the states decide, right? I mean, that's considered a perfectly defensible answer when it comes to something like abortion, right? Abortion's a really controversial hot button topic in the way a lot of libertarian types deal with that, especially if they, you know, for the libertarians that run for public, you know, for the federal level, the way they kind of punt that one is to say, well, let the states decide. And I don't think that's a cop. I think it's true. Yeah, what the heck does the federal government have to tell people in Kansas or other places what to do when it comes to abortion? So in a similar fashion, you might say, oh, but letting people in the country, no, that's not a national issue. Why should people in North Dakota have any say in how many people from Mexico should go into Texas, right? Or going the other way around. Why should people in Hawaii, through their voting for president and for members of Congress, why should they have any say in how many people can cross from Canada into the northern U.S. states? That doesn't affect the people in Hawaii very much. So why do they get to decide on that? So you see what I'm saying? That actually immigration from other places is largely affecting the border states, certainly affecting the border states a lot more than other places. And so I think it's both correct ideologically and also in terms of politically. If you're forcing me to say something about the current state of politics or whatever, and you want me to be practical and reasonable and not just be a purist and talk about anarcho-capitalist world, okay, well then, you know, that should be something devolved to the states and let the individual state governments decide how it's going to be handled. I think that makes much more sense than, you know, to say, oh, the federal government ought to have this policy for what happens, you know, for the country as a whole to determine how many total people come into or out of the country. That's crazy. Last thing I'll say on this, again, not that it's an argument stopper, but with these issues of, you know, voting and this kind of stuff, because I know, you know, you could say, well, gee, why don't you let people in? And, you know, some practical compromise positions. I've seen people say, hey, well, let people in and just say they can't ever vote, or that, you know, neither they nor their kids can be U.S. citizens and they can't go to government schools and get food stamps and that kind of stuff. You know, and shouldn't that be a compromise? Or, you know, one thing that I'm surprised more people don't talk about is, especially with the ballooning national debt, why don't they say something like, oh, yeah, as many people can come in as they want, but you have to get some domestic person to put, or foreign government for that matter, to post whatever, $100,000 payment, and that's your ticket into this country. You got to pay $100,000, boom, flat fee to get in or something like that. You know, there's all sorts of things you could imagine that would make more sense than the status quo that you think everybody would agree is preferable to status quo. Not that everyone would agree it's the best outcome, but what we have right now is crazy. And other people could plausibly say in response to that, well, no, because even if we had a deal where, oh, we're going to let in millions of immigrants from third world countries and, you know, they're going to sign a piece of paper saying, I'm never going to take welfare benefits. And even if I have kids, you know, they're not going to automatically be U.S. citizens. Well, you know what? I don't trust Nancy Pelosi or Ocasio-Cortez and her ilk. 10 years from now, we're going to renege on that deal. And all of a sudden, they're going to have all these Democratic voters who are sitting there, potential Democratic voter, and I don't trust them. They're going to move to, you know, naturalize them and blah, blah, blah. And that's a very plausible concern. I agree with someone who has that kind of mentality. All I want to say, and this is my concluding thought, is I saw an article, and I'll link to it in the show notes page, from Walter Block and Gene Callahan. I don't know if they invented this argument, but it was the first place I had encountered it, where they said, a lot of the arguments to say that the federal government ought to use coercion or force, let's say, to be less loaded, to prevent people from entering the country that are based on considerations like food stamps or, you know, welfare benefits more generally, or strategic considerations about voting patterns. And, oh, you don't want people coming in here who don't, you know, understand the principles of liberty and the founding fathers, and they have no history of understanding Republican government. That's fine. But notice you could apply those arguments to people who are currently U.S. citizens having more kids, right? You can certainly point to certain groups in the United States right now where you could say, hey, statistically speaking, if these people have a lot more kids, chances are they're going to be drained on the taxpayer and they're probably going to vote Democratic. And yet I think most people would recoil in horror at the suggestion that, you know, those people should be barred legally from having more kids, or even more horrifying, that the government should go sterilize them or something like that, right? That you could say, even though it's true that, you know, there might be more inroads into political freedom down the road because these people have a lot more kids, nonetheless, you're not allowed to violate someone's basic rights because you think you're therefore, you know, guaranteeing a greater respect for rights down the road or in the long run. That's not a standard libertarian view to say something like, particularly a radical libertarian view, right? So again, not that that's a definitive end to all arguments, but my point is, for a lot of people, just take your arguments by which you want to have the U.S. government regulate the flow of people into the country because you're, you know, basing it on welfare considerations or voting patterns, and just say, well, would that also apply to current citizens and whether they have more kids or not? And I'm thinking probably a lot of you would not have that view line up. Oh, I lied. One last consideration with the wall. Let me not have any ambiguity about it. I am totally against the U.S. federal government building a wall on the border, not because of the, you know, these immigration issues and, you know, the economics of it or whatever, nothing to do with that, because if and when there is a huge police state, and people say, well, they're already here, but I'm saying when it's, you know, the kind of police state that's featured in dystopian movies about the future, where there's flying surveillance drones and all that kind of stuff, certainly one of the characteristics is going to be a physical border making it hard to escape from the U.S. Okay, so I'm not saying that that's what's motivating the current people who are for it. I'm not saying the current people who are for a wall are racist or anything. You notice I haven't said any of that kind of stuff. All I'm saying is, for those of you who really don't trust the government, again, this is, you know, that government down the road, not the current, maybe the current people in it, but down the road, that's just going to be one more way of them controlling your children, let's say, or your grandchildren, and they're going to grow up in a world where the U.S. government is monitoring financial transactions, you know, all sorts of other things. And one of the attributes, I think, in that world is going to be giant physical borders to keep people in. And so certainly I think it would be foolish for us to contribute to that thinking, oh, we'll just get the right people in office and they'll let in the kind of immigrants we like and keep up the kind of, that's goofy. You're giving people in Washington more power because they're promising to do something that you like. And when has that ever worked out well? Okay. Well, with all that, folks, thanks for your attention. For links on this topic, again, with BobMurphyShow.com/11, and I'll see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit BobMurphyShow.com.